Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And our first guest today says there probably isn't a five-mile stretch of interstate between northern Illinois and Minnesota, the Minnesota border, where MedFlight hasn't landed and cared for someone. Dr. Michael Abernathy, our guest now. He served 34 years as a flight physician with UW Health MedFlight before he retired in April. And we asked him to come in to talk about his experience and to talk about the program itself. It's a pretty wonderful, I would call it, program that we have here in our state. And as we talk with Dr. Abernathy, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about in-flight emergency medicine? Have you maybe been involved in some way with an emergency of this nature? Love to hear your comments about that. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Michael Abernathy, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on your career. I mean, 34 years. Is there any other person that you know in the entire United States that has had a longer tenure?
Well, as a flight physician in the United States, it's not as common as other countries, and I do some international work. But, yeah, I still haven't found anyone who's been doing it, as far as physician, who's been doing it continuously as long as I have.
Yeah. How do you look back on your career with that? I mean, what do you think about your career?
I think, you know, I look back at it with gratitude. I mean, I was right place, right time, and right career. You know, this is something that, you know, I trained for. And unfortunately, in my early training at the University of Chicago, it prepared me well. And it's been interesting as the industry and medicine has evolved over the last 35 years.
I was thinking back to how many radio shows I've done. And, you know, when you're thinking about retiring and so forth, you must have some idea about how many people you served, or maybe not.
Yeah. As far as flights and patients transported, it's somewhere over just over 4,000. And that's over the last 34 plus, actually 37 years, because prior to coming to the University of Wisconsin, I trained and was a flight physician with the University of Chicago for 3 years.
And probably cared for many outpatients as well over that.
Yes, that's, you know, during all this, I've always worked in the emergency department in addition to my flight duties. So I've always had sort of two full-time jobs, and I've probably seen close to 100,000 patients in the emergency department since I've finished medical school.
Yeah. Just thinking about some of the stories. I mean, as I understand it, UW Health sends an attending physician on every flight.
Yes. They have a tremendous, and that's one thing that back in the 80s, it was more common to have physicians on the helicopter. The industry was much smaller back then. But as the years have gone on and the financial and political things have changed in the air medical industry, it's largely, you know, the majority of the country is nurse or nurse paramedic. But the University of Wisconsin has, you know, has this commitment to quality. And they talk about the Wisconsin idea, you know, bringing the fruits of the university out to the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, there's no other place in the world where, you know, you can get in a car crash or a farming accident and the helicopter comes and you have a professor of emergency medicine at your bedside or at the roadside or farm side caring for you. So it is a unique situation.
It is indeed. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the changes. I mean, from over 30 years, a lot's changed in my field.
Yeah. Well, both on the aviation and the technology side, and then emergency medicine itself as a specialty, you know, it was in its infancy when I started residency in the late 80s. It was just recognized as its own specialty, I believe, in 1986. So we were sort of the new guys. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the development prior to that, emergency medicine was just, collection of physicians who had an interest in emergency medicine. And the ER was staffed by rotating house staff. So 1 week covering the ER where I grew up in Steubenville, Ohio, it was that model in our hospital. We'd have 1 week, you'd have a surgeon covering the ER. The next week, you'd have a pediatrician. The next week, a pathologist, you know. So the medicine and, has come a long way. But, the technology, too. You know, in 1988, when I graduated medical school, you know, there was no internet. There were no cell phones. So, the gathering of information. And then on the aviation side, you know, we have things like GPS navigation and the engine technology and the safety, you know, has come a long way.
Yeah. I have a friend, a physician friend, who when he started, he wanted to be in emergency medicine. One of the reasons was he didn't want to have a regular practice.
Right. Yeah, and it's funny, though, working in the community. I've worked in, in addition to UW, I've worked in the Beloit Health System for almost 34 years. And I've taken care of people now. I'm taking care of their children and their grandchildren. So in some way, we are sort of the urban general practitioner.
What's it like to serve, to be in a, I mean, how many helicopter trips have you taken? I thought, you must have been in some pretty, with some pretty good helicopter pilots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the pilots are excellent. And, you know, fortunately, our vendors who supply the helicopters and, you know, because safety is a big issue. You know, every time you leave the ground, you know, there's an inherent risk. You know, gravity is a law, not a suggestion.
Yeah.
And, you know, we take safety very seriously.
How, to what extent is the helicopter equipped with medical, you know, supplies and perhaps other equipment that can be used on the site?
Yeah, we truly have, you know, they talk about an emergency room in the air or an ICU in the air. As technology has developed, you know, for airway manipulation, for IV pumps, monitoring patients, we can do things now that we couldn't dream of 20 years ago. And by trial and error, the nice thing is in this business, you know, I've learned what you need and what you don't need. Because unlike an ambulance or an emergency department, you know, you can have stacks of equipment you don't use. But on a helicopter, you can't have dead weight. You know, you have to choose your equipment and your drugs and all that very carefully. It's part of its trial and error, part of its research, part of its learning from other programs.
How much information typically would you get, or do you get anything when somebody calls them and says there's a crash on 94 and we got people hurt?
Yeah, not much. We like to know the size of the patients because weight is a critical aspect, you know, with the helicopter, depending on we have a variability on how much fuel we have on board. But we usually don't have a lot of information, and that's okay. It's not going to change what I'm going to do. Just like in the emergency department, stuff comes in the door, boom. You know, we can have a cardiac arrest. We can have someone with serious neurologic problems. We don't have a lot of heads up. So that's the nature of the specialty is you have to be ready for anything, you know.
What's the most important, or what are the most important things that you have to know as a physician? You know, I'm thinking you're going to be the guy in charge when it lands, when the plane lands, a helicopter lands.
Right. It's just you. There's no cavalry, you know, to come rescue. Whereas in the emergency department at UW, if we get a trauma, we have a huge trauma team. We have surgeons, anesthesiologists, you know, all that's when we land at the side of the road, you know, it's just me and my flight nurse. And so, you know, that's one of the key things is, you know, we have, it's not just the flight physician. It is a team effort between the nurse and the doctor, but also between the pilot and dispatch. But, you know, I would say, you know, the training that goes into things, the teamwork. I have one nurse that I've worked with for almost 30 years, and we've seen hundreds of patients together. So, you know, we sometimes don't even have to talk. We can anticipate each other's, you know, thoughts and movements, and it's almost like telepathy. It's scary.
I was thinking in your line of work, empathy has got to play a role here. Empathy for your patients.
It does. You know, it's always, you know, I come home after, you know, a hard day or after seeing a lot of things, and you know, you see people on their very worst day, and you can't forget that because it becomes a job just like anything else. You know, there's astronauts, oh, going up in space, that's just another day of work. You know, and people look at this, but it does become a job. But you never forget, you know, what your purpose is and what you're doing. And when you're seeing these people or, you know, taking a sick child from the arms of their parents at an outlying hospital, you know, how traumatic that is for these people when it's their absolute worst day. And so, you know, you have to remember that. And I think I do a pretty good job at that.
Yeah, you must. Dr. Michael Abernathy, our guest, he served 34 years as a flight physician with UW Health MedFlight, just recently retired, talking with him about his role in that. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. What are your thoughts about the med flights? Have you experienced in some way or another a med flight? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the career of Dr. Michael Abernathy, who served 34 years as a flight physician with UW Health MedFlight. And I hope you'll join in. I see we have some callers coming online right now. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. What really drew you to, by the way, to this whole career anyway, emergency medicine?
Yeah, but there's really no straight lines in my career path. I grew up in Eastern Ohio, and like many of the people I graduated high school with in the 70s, you know, my idea, I was going to go work in the steel mills. You know, it was good money. It was regular jobs. And after doing that for a while, I found out that I really don't want to do this for the rest of my life. So I wandered into a part-time university and started a career in engineering and finished up my engineering degree at The Ohio State University. And during that time, I became involved in pre-hospital care as an EMT. And actually, in the earlier days, you know, people don't realize that even in the 70s, a large portion of the ambulance services in the United States were provided by funeral homes. Oh. Before this idea of, you know, forgotten an emergency medicine technician and this specialty of emergency medicine services, it was largely left up, you know, to the local funeral homes. They had the caddy hearses, and at that time I was a volunteer attendant as a teenager, and I was first aid certified through the Red Cross. And I look back on it, and oh, the things I saw as a kid, you know, was just me and taking care of these patients. And I realized, you know, I sort of had an aptitude for it and I could handle the stress. And eventually I did have formal training, became an EMT. But then after work in engineering, I had joined the military with the Ohio National Guard and became involved in an aviation unit and sort of then combined the two of them and ended up in emergency medicine.
That's quite a career. And a little bit winding, but I mean, if you think about it, all that training over time, really, I mean, even in engineering, you probably learned a lot that may have applied to your work as a doctor, physician.
Oh, absolutely. It's a good pre-med where I went to the University of Cincinnati. I think we had about 15 or 20% of my class were engineers as pre-med. So it is. It's a very rigorous undergrad. And yeah.
Yeah. My friend was in engineering and started a company and made a lot of money in it, and then decided he wanted to go into medicine after that.
Yeah.
So there you go. Linda and New Glarus, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Yes. I was, my life was saved by a med flight, which picked me up after an accident I had. I was bleeding out. I had fractures in my legs. I had bones sticking out of one leg. And I was picked up by the med flight in New Glarus, Wisconsin, and taken to the UW-Madison. And I can't say enough about those people. They saved my life. And I was met. They took me right to the emergency. We landed on the roof. And they took me into the emergency, and Dr. Doro met us there. And I have to have a shout out to him, Dr. Doro at the UW. He was wonderful. He patched me up, he fixed me, and I am walking normally today, and I would never have even survived without the med flight. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah. Again, MedFlight, we are just a link in the chain, though. And that's one thing I never forget. You know, starting with the wonderful EMS and the volunteers in New Glarus who probably took care of you. I've worked with them for 20, 30 years. To the MedFlight team, to our emergency department and trauma services, to the orthopedic services. Again, it's, you know, we're sort of the glitzy ones. We fly in the helicopter. It's a big billboard for UW, but we are just a link in the chain.
Yeah. Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Let's turn to Cheryl in Iron Ridge. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. How are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to mention two things to Dr. Abernathy. When I heard he was going to be on today, I couldn't forget my best old buddy John Sharp passed away a number of years ago. I was a medical sales rep for many, many, many years, and I called on paramedics, and I can't tell you, living up north, I lived there for 30 years, without med flight, I'm telling you, this state is so lucky to have med flight. You have no idea how important that is for our state of Wisconsin. And I was not paid to say this. I just know from all the years of working with John Sharp and the Madison Fire Department, EMTs, paramedics, and the doctors at UW-Madison and the flight people, you guys are just the best. Just the best. There is no better.
Oh, Cheryl, thanks for calling.
Yeah, John Sharp, what a character. He was one of Madison's first paramedic. He's a Marine Corps veteran, one of our first dispatchers, and worked many a shift with John. And fabulous individual. He left us way too early.
Yeah. Cheryl, thank you for calling. Do you get feedback from folks along the way, I mean, after the fact?
Once in a while, it's not uncommon, whether, you know, they come through the emergency department or I'll run into them. We do what we call PR community events where the helicopter will land at a community days. And a lot of times there, I'll meet some of my old patients or people I transported. Some of them I remember, some of them I don't. Again, from their standpoint, this was you know, probably one of the most important days of their lives, most stressful times, and they remember it. But unfortunately, you know, I said I've transported 4,000 people. I don't remember everybody, but yeah.
I feel the same way about the students that I've had
over
the years.
Yeah.
You know, I've had thousands of them, and I remember many. And
yeah, there's some that really stick out and others that just sort of, yeah.
Yeah. Nancy in Rome, Wisconsin, that's different, called. She couldn't stay with us, though, but in her rural Wisconsin area, residents pay a monthly fee for a med flight service. She is concerned of how the expense of the service, should you need it. She worries she could not afford to pay the bill if she had to.
Yeah, it's the industry has changed a lot over the years. You know, back in the 90s, it, for example, for UW, the structure of programs is different from state to state. And fortunately, in Wisconsin, the majority of the programs we have are what's called hospital-based. So I am a service of UW, just like anesthesia or surgery or something like that. So when you're transported by med flight, you know, to UW or one of our other hospitals in Madison, it's just another service that's rolled into the bill and discounted and, you know, all of the things according to your health care plan and things like that. But in other areas of the country, there are some problems. And, you know, it's taken over by private equity, which is a problem in health care. And so it can become expensive, you know, depending, again, on your coverage and insurance.
Yeah. Someone else is wondering, how do you handle the deaths of patients during transit to a hospital? Or has that happened? I assume it has.
Yes, it does. You know, there's some where it's somewhat expected. You know, you get a bad accident, you get the patient, and you just got to run with them and do what you can en route and hope for the best. Most of the time, again, we have a physician on board, so if need be, we can stop resuscitation and basically pronounce the patient. But we do have deaths in flight. Again, it's usually not expected. Usually we have some idea, you know, where things are heading.
Yeah. The UW established its emergency medical program, medicine program, in, was it 2007, something like that?
The Emergency Medicine Residency Training Program, correct,
yeah.
2007.
And you served as you're a teacher or served as a trainer at part of that program, right?
One of the faculty, yeah, and I still do. I work with the residents in the community environment in Beloit, too.
So the skills that are taught, what are the skills that are taught?
Oh, geez. You just have to know more and more about less and less until you know absolutely everything about nothing. So, yeah, that's the thing about emergency medicine is, you know, you really have to be ready for anything to come in the door, whether it's, you know, critical care, cardiac care, pediatrics. You know, I'll care for a 2-week, 3-week-old child, and then you go to the next room, and I have a 98-year-old with chest pain. So we really have to cover the spectrum of medicine, and we sort of take all the sort of the best bits of all the specialties and learn them.
Yeah. Dr. Michael Abernathy, our guest, and if you have a question, comment, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@wpr.org. I know you've received honors for your years you've spent teaching in the United Kingdom. Tell us about that experience and what you were doing there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, just the whole world's opened up, and this is partially due to the idea of social media, because it's really easy to become sort of isolated, and medicine tends to do that geographically. We do it this way in Wisconsin, they do it that way in New York or California. But now with the advent of social media and connecting with like minds, you know, the geography is just thrown out. And through that, back in, you know, the early 2010 or so, started to discover more and more people involved in what we call HEMS, which is Helicopter Emergency Medical Services, which, as far as physician staffed, is more common in Europe and Australia and Asia than it is in the United States. So connecting with these people. And I remember there was a conference in Scotland. It was one of my first forays overseas back in about 2012, where I had followed this online, and I said, I've got to meet these people. And so the next year I went to the conference, and oh my God, you know, these are my people. And it's just run since then. You know, the connections I've made and the people I've met in the industry, you know, I'm a handshake away from almost anyone in helicopter EMS in the world.
And you were the first American to teach courses in anesthesia, trauma, and what was the other? Critical care in the UK?
Yeah, there's a program I'm involved with. In fact, next week I go to Ireland to teach a course there, but that's called ATAC, Anesthesia, Trauma, and Critical Care. And it's sort of a specialty course teaching nurses, doctors, and paramedics trauma care, but it's not in the warm confines of an emergency department or an operating room. It's out in the field with very realistic scenarios, collapsed buildings, train wrecks, all this. So we run the candidates through a lot of this. So it's not only just learning the medicine and the techniques, it's dealing with the emotional aspects yeah. and the pressure and all that. So it's a wonderful organization that I've been with for about 10 years now. And I get over 2-3 times a year to teach the course.
That sounds fantastic. Brett in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Larry. Great program. We're going to miss you, man. But for Dr. Abernathy, thanks for your service. My dad was an Air Force flight surgeon during the Vietnam War. So he didn't have to fly helicopters. So, and I know we actually had to medevac a doctor from the bottom of the Grand Canyon once, but we had to carry him 3,000 feet up and his gear to get radio service. So that's not recommended. But for you, sir, I mean, obviously a lot of your business is generated by automobiles. And New York Times says that cars have killed more Americans than all other wars put together. What can drivers do to try to reduce your business load? In addition, other than slowing down. So that's
all right, Brett, thank you for calling.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've seen a radical change in my even just 30 years in emergency medicine, 30 to 40, just in car engineering. You know, when I started driving, people didn't wear seatbelts. You know, and then the car design with crumple zones, airbags, things like that have radically changed the fatalities. But human behavior is, you know, the thing we have to modify. Drinking and driving still is a huge problem. Fortunately, it's become more and more on the front lines and people are addressing it. Safety belts, absolutely. It's a shame. I've seen so many accidents where the person probably would have walked away from the rollover if they were wearing their seatbelts. Those are probably the two biggest thing. And it's just, you know, being aware of your surroundings and, you know, taking the responsibility. I've got a granddaughter that's going through driver's ed right now, and it scares me. But I think the engineering has changed radically. That's good. But, yeah, we still have to take care of human behavior.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Brett, thank you for calling. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Are auto accidents the most common, I would assume?
No, not at all. So as things have changed, about 80% of our business is transporting patients from outlying hospitals to UW or St. Mary's. Yeah, as we've EMS and ground EMS has developed more and more, even if there's a car accident, say, out at Baraboo, that patient, it's closer for them to bring them to the hospital initially and then call us. But really, trauma makes up 20-30% of what we do. A lot of it's cardiac care. Stroke is a big thing, because time-dependent issues with stroke and cardiac care. Pediatric, critical care, all that. But
someone else has got another email. Somebody else is wondering, have you ever had a scare in the helicopter? I mean, with bad weather or whatever.
Aviation, fortunately less and less. Again, with technology, back in the day when I started, we didn't have a 24/7 instant weather, like you can pull up on your phone and see the weather radar. That didn't exist. So a lot of the times it was back in the day, we'd go up and take a look. And sometimes you get into bad weather. Sometimes you got into forced landings, putting down in a cornfield somewhere to ride out the weather. But that's a rarity now. Again, the technology has really helped us out.
I can imagine dropping down in somebody's cornfield.
Yeah, and it used to be not an uncommon occurrence to get trapped by weather, and unfortunately there were a lot of accidents associated with that back in the day. But as the technology has developed, we can get a pretty, it's not 100%, but we can get a pretty good idea of the weather, along our route.
Yeah, my uncle lost both his arms in a corn picker here, and that would have been landing in the cornfield.
Oh, yeah.
Linda in Cable, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi there. I love the topic. I always wanted to fly a helicopter. Well, I'm 70, and that ain't going to happen now. So the next best thing, I wanted a helicopter ride, but of no trace of my own. I was in the hospital, and they put some dye in me, which attacked my heart, and it snuffed me. So they beat me up, cracked ribs, got me back. 10 minutes later, it attacked my heart again. They got me back, and they said, we can't help you anymore, so you get your first helicopter ride. So I did. They flew me from Hayward down to Eau Claire because Hayward couldn't handle. They didn't have the equipment, yada, yada, yada. But the sad thing is, the whole trip down there, winter, in the dark, they strapped me down, and I couldn't look out the window. I wanted to look out the window. I want to see. And then I was half naked anyhow, so I was freezing my arms off. It's like, crud. But anyhow, I would have loved to have been a helicopter flyer back in the day.
Linda.
Larry, we're going to miss you. Thank you very much for all your years.
Thank you, Linda. And I'm wondering, have you gotten involved in situations like what Linda's describing here, from one hospital to another hospital?
Oh, that's usually the most common thing we do, transferring from the smaller community hospitals. And to get a view, once in a while, if the patient, depending on their medical condition, we will sit them up because it's wonderful. It never gets old, flying over the Wisconsin countryside.
Yeah, I had one air helicopter flight between Charles de Gaulle and Orly, I think, airports. And it was an experience that I won't forget. It's really something. Keith and Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hi. My question, earlier you said that when you were young, you felt you had an aptitude for that, that you could handle the stress of that career. I tried to volunteer for a fire department when I was in my early teens or late teens, and my adrenaline just couldn't handle that. What do you think makes the difference for someone like yourself that you could handle that stress of these crises?
That's a good question. Thanks, Keith.
Yeah, great question. I think part of it's genetic. And it's interesting, in emergency medicine, I see the same thing. You know, it's just someone's God-given makeup that allows them to handle such situations, you know, without falling apart or getting too emotional. Now, granted, you can learn by being exposed and, you know, through my training. I trained on the south side of Chicago and saw a lot of stuff. So, you know, I think part of it has to do with good training, good support during that period. But there are people, yeah, and by no fault of their own, that just aren't cut out for it and cannot handle, you know, seeing all of that. So I think combination of genetics and good training.
Just thinking back to when I was a kid, I lived in a rural area, and 12 and 18 was just over the hill from our farm. And when we heard the sirens, we knew right where the accident would be, because many of them happened right in
Springfield
that.
Corners?
Springfield Corners was one. No, yeah. This was, I know that, but there was another sharp, kind of a sharp corner on old 12 and 18. This is before the road went through.
We used to pick up a lot of patients before they fixed that road, yeah.
I can remember biking over there and seeing a couple of folks who had passed away in an accident. And I wasn't so quick to go over there after that.
Nah.
It's not an experience that most of us, in fact, probably all of us could handle better than you've done.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for your work and for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you about the MedFlight and your career there. Thank you.
Again, thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Dr. Michael Abernathy served 34 years as a flight physician with UW Health MedFlight. It was great to have him with us. And coming up, we're going to turn our attention to a terrible disease, Alzheimer's. A couple of guests for you next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Alzheimer's disease affects many people here in our state and, of course, across the country. And we have a couple of guests with us to talk about Alzheimer's. Dr. Cindy Carlson is director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. Dr. Cindy Carlson, welcome to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And with us as well, Bill Stork. Well, I always call him Dr. Bill but he's a veterinarian, not a medical doctor. But he is Lake Mills veterinarian and is organizing a fundraiser for Alzheimer's research, which is why he's with us today. So looking forward to talking with them about the disease, and I hope you'll join in and with your own thoughts, questions, comments. How has Alzheimer's affected your family? Perhaps. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Carlson, turn to you first. What causes Alzheimer's and how does it typically progress for people?
That's a great question. A lot of people start with wondering how dementia is different than Alzheimer's. And dementia is a term where we see describe what we see in the person. So if somebody has memory problems, thinking problems, and it affects their day-to-day function, so maybe they're not just forgetting their car keys, but getting lost, getting somewhere, or can't balance their checkbook or you know, navigate their usual activities they usually do. That's what we see in the person. That's the dementia. And then we have to figure out what's causing the dementia. And that's where Alzheimer's comes in, because Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia. And it's really the main things that we've seen are that it's caused by these two proteins, amyloid and tau. And what they do is they build up in the brain, they cause the nerve cells in the brain not to function as well, and then that affects our thinking abilities. And so where in the brain it occurs depends on if it's going to cause memory problems, trouble finding words, or other thinking processes. Problems.
Yeah. And it progresses.
Or it does progress.
It always progresses, doesn't it?
If it's truly Alzheimer's disease, it always progresses, yeah.
Yeah, my mother passed away of Alzheimer's, and it was it wasn't a fun experience at all. Bill, I was just going to add, you have a family history with it as well.
I do, to the extent that when my grandpa had Alzheimer's, we didn't even call it Alzheimer's. They called it hardening of the arteries, and I have some god-awful memories of my grandpa during that time.
Yeah. I'm wondering, here's Bill and I. We have family with Alzheimer's. What's the potential impact for a sibling or a relative, a close relative of somebody with Alzheimer's?
That's a great question. And again, I have Alzheimer's in my family too. And actually, most people in our research program do, and that's why we're doing this work. But again, you know, my great-grandmother had memory problems when she was in her mid-90s. And then her daughter, my grandmother, started getting memory problems in her early 70s. And so that's what got me thinking, why did one person get to live to be in their mid-90s before they got memory problems? And then this next generation having it happen so early on. And so there's a lot of things we're trying to better understand. It does tend to run in families in some cases. There's some, thankfully, pretty rare conditions where people will have Alzheimer's like in half of their siblings. And that's usually, thankfully, pretty rare. And those are different genetic types. But most of the time, what we're talking about is just Alzheimer's that tends to happen more typically in our 70s, 80s. But it can happen earlier. It can happen in their 50s and 60s. And so there's so many factors that contribute. So we're trying to figure out, what are the lifestyle factors? What are the other genetic factors and other things so we can really chip away at reducing risk for Alzheimer's disease?
So there is some genetic
component
to it. And lifestyle component?
There's lifestyle, too. There's we know all those things we're told to do, exercise, eat healthy, lower fats, get good rest. They do all these studies to show us that all those things are good for our brain as well as good for our heart and cancer reduction and things like that, too.
Yeah. Again, I'll mention a question or comment or an experience to share. Give a call, 800-642-1234. You can email the talk at WPR.org. And Bill, you raise money for Alzheimer's research.
Bill got it started. And to be clear about this situation, you said Dr. Stork organized it. Dr. Stork came up with the idea. Anything that resembles organization is thanks to my wife, Sheila, and the team that she has assembled behind her. So let's be absolutely clear about that. And then Bill's got somewhat of a platform. And by my way of thinking, if you have a platform, you are to use it for good in some way, shape, or form. And that's become Alzheimer's. And there have been a number of people who have stepped up. I mean, there's names like Joe Tritton and our buddy Dan, Sylvia Sipple, who have stepped up in very big ways. There are sponsors like Thompson Investment Advisors, Matthew Pomerantz, in town, local businesses like SAMFT, accounting services. And there are people who have given $5, and we are equally grateful for every single solitary nickel.
And we'll talk some more about that as we go along, because you do some bike touring.
If I have to.
Oh, man. What's the financial picture when it comes to research dollars relating to this, Dr. Carlson?
It had about 10 years ago, there's a big push with research funding for Alzheimer's disease, which was amazing because then it drew in people from all different disciplines, creative ideas, to kind of think about how we approach Alzheimer's. And we made some great progress there. In the last several years, it's been, especially over this past year or so, it's really become more challenging for people to get research funding because a lot of it we depend on National Institutes of Health and other federal funding, and that's just, that landscape's changed. So what we're trying to do is think about new partnerships, new ways to fund research opportunities. And this is where, you know, people like Bill, who come up with these ideas for fundraising, are so important, because they help us kind of bridge those gaps when the grants are just redistributed. So it's still there, but the funding for Alzheimer's has gone down, which slows down progress, unfortunately.
Also
affects junior, like young investigators who are interested in maybe choosing Alzheimer's discovery as a field for themselves.
So how much, let's say the last 20 years, how much have we improved our understanding of Alzheimer's?
It has been amazing 20 years. If the first 100 years after Alzheimer's discovered, the plaques and tangles were slow, but there's progress made. The last 20 years, now we have new therapies that actually go after the underlying cause, the amyloid. We have new biomarkers or blood tests that can tell us if someone is at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And we have a lot better understanding that Alzheimer's usually doesn't happen by itself in the brain. There's usually other causes that are mixed in there. So we it's increased our understanding that we got to target these other factors too, or else we're not going to help keep the brain healthy if we're only going after Alzheimer's.
Yeah. And we're going to be at the bottom of the hour today. We're going to be spending a half hour talking about the blood testing that is available now, because that's kind of fascinating stuff in and of itself. So it's dementia, and then it's diagnosed as Alzheimer's. What's the diagnosis process? I mean, how does somebody land in that?
That's a great question. So we have one little plug, is that we have memory clinics throughout the state. So our Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute has memory clinics throughout the state. So if people are looking for ways to get diagnosed, those clinics, we work closely with them. So that's on our website as well. But what people usually do is they'll come in and share a memory complaint with their primary care provider, and either the primary care provider or another clinic team will talk with them and figure out what's happened first. Is it memory? Is it language changes? And really get a sense of how these memory changes have affected that person's life. So a lot of it is talking with patients and families, getting a full picture of what's happening. And then a lot of diagnosis before recently was just ruling out other things. So do they have bad sleep apnea? Do they have medication side effects or other things that are affecting their thinking abilities, and cleaning that up? And then a lot of times before, it was just kind of a process of elimination. Look, there's no other medical causes. It's probably Alzheimer's. So we could never really kind of be sure that it was Alzheimer's. Yeah. We kind of guessed. But when you talk with Dr. Chin later today, he'll be able to talk about the advances in those blood tests and some of the brain scans that help us to say, is this really Alzheimer's or not?
Boy. And the treatments, there really is not a cure.
There's not a cure right now. There's a couple of pills that have been available, some medications that have been available for about 20 years, and they do help the nerve cells in the brain function better, but they don't really get rid of the root cause of the condition. The new therapies, the last 2 years or several years, there have been two new therapies that are given through the veins, and what they do is they go in and they clear out the amyloid. So they clear out one of the key processes that we know contributes to Alzheimer's. And it slows down memory decline in addition to the pills. But even with those therapies that have been pretty breakthrough, they still doesn't stop the decline or make people's memory better. So that's where we have work to do still.
Stephen in Eau Claire, thanks for calling.
Hi, I had family member with Alzheimer's, and also read about and studied with Dale Bredesen, and wonder if you had any experience with his research and his outcomes.
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, Dale Bredesen has pulls together a lot of research ideas and different therapies and things that can be pulled together to help live a healthier lifestyle. And there are some things that have been good evidence behind that, controlling blood pressure and other healthy lifestyle factors that we can get back to. And
yeah, we'll get back. Thanks a lot, Stephen, for calling. Appreciate it. We're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our two guests, Dr. Cynthia Carlson and Bill Stork, Great to have them with us, and I hope you'll join in with your questions as well. We'll be back right after the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking Alzheimer's disease and some events, or a big event that's coming up that we want to talk about as well. Two guests for you, Dr. Cynthia Carlson, professor of geriatrics and gerontology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She directs the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, co-leader of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And Bill Stork, Dr. Bill Stork, is a veterinarian, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, fundraiser for Alzheimer's research at UW-Madison through the Mines Over Mountains bike tour. And he's even got a Mines Over Mountain shirt on today. So it's great to have that as well. Yeah, lots of callers online. And I know you, Dr. Carlson, you wanted to mention or talk perhaps a little bit more about Dale Bredesen, who was an earlier caller had mentioned.
Right, yeah. So I think, you know, Dale Bredesen, and then there's some other people who really are trying to find out other complementary therapies that they can do or lifestyle changes they can do to help with their risk for Alzheimer's disease. And so, you know, there are a lot of studies out there, but there's really not too much data, good evidence behind a lot of the complementary therapies yet. There's a good website NIH has, so National Institutes of Health has a complementary medicine website people can go to look at the evidence. But there are a few things that are proven. So exercise, walking, controlling blood pressure. So any kind of movement and blood pressure control are extremely helpful. There's a lot of other therapies looking at different things, you know, different studies looking at curcumin and other extracts, but those aren't proven yet. So there's things in the works, but not great evidence so far.
Mindy in Janesville has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mindy.
Hi there. My mom hasn't been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but she was diagnosed some time ago with vascular dementia, and then sometime after that with Parkinson's. And I've seen her brain scans when they have said that vascular dementia, you know, she's had some mini strokes and there's a lot of vascular changes, but her mind is still sort of seems with it. And then it's kind of seems sort of like made more sense when they gave us the Parkinson's diagnosis. I haven't talked to her doctor as much since that diagnosis, but do they go hand in hand? Can she have both? Are there different treatments for both of those conditions?
Sure.
Does it make sense for her to have vascular dementia and still pass memory tests?
Yeah, Mindy, you're bringing up an excellent question, because we used to only think that people had one type or the other. We think people had Alzheimer's or they had vascular or Lewy body dementia. And now we realize about 75% or more of people with dementia have what we call mixed pathologies or a variety of causes all at the same time. So that your mom has some brain changes from vascular disease in her brain and Parkinson's, that makes sense, because sometimes the vascular changes actually can trigger Parkinson's-like symptoms. Sometimes they can just occur in, you know, both conditions in the same person. So I think talking with her doctor makes a lot of sense, just to see what's the best treatment for her. You know, treatment of the blood vessel risk factors and treatment of the Parkinson's symptoms. But it's much more common than we used to think. So that's a great question.
Thanks, Mindy. Appreciate it. John in Manitowoc, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I guess I'm going to talk a little bit about the advocacy piece, if I may. Throughout the summer and then into fall, Walk to End Alzheimer's, sponsored by Alzheimer's Association, gets going on. Manitowoc actually has theirs tomorrow. Information on our Facebook page. Anyway, I just found them to be a wonderful resource. My mom passed away about 10 years ago now from Alzheimer's. Her birthday is actually coming up June 10th, the 100th anniversary of that. And, just wanted to say it's a great community. It's a great place for support.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Comment on that?
Yeah, the Alzheimer's Association has been a great advocacy group in helping to spread the word nationally. And there's a lot of other great local groups. So even events, you know, like what Bill's going to be leading this weekend, these types of events that increase awareness, help people not to feel alone, help them to find purpose in what they're doing and the journeys they're taking with their family members. So there's a lot of great organizations nationally and locally. Increasing awareness is always helpful.
And it seems like the perfect time, Bill, for you to talk about your event, Minds Over Mountains.
Well, absolutely, Larry. And to dovetail onto that, sure, we've made some money to help Cindy and the folks at the UW Initiative to End Alzheimer's. But I realized in the middle of the event last year that we had achieved our goal, and that is to bring people together, people who have been caregivers, which I will fly the flag of CNAs and hospice workers and people in nursing homes and gerontologists who help care for families and people affected. But the event, June the 14th, Tyrannina Brewing Company in Lake Mills, Wisconsin, we've made some very specific arrangements for perfect weather, 74 degrees and sunshine. If by some chance there's an absolute rainout or if musical equipment is in danger, we will shovel down to the Pharmacy Public House in Lake Mills, Wisconsin. But live auction and silent auction, we have everything from literally, would it be Wisconsin if there was not a meat raffle? And a good friend Jason and Charlie Unts have donated a quarter of a steer of beef from the south side of town to a Green Bay Packer bicycle from Two Rivers Bike and Sports in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. One of the coolest things, I've got a wonderful friend down in Rockford who owns a cable wake park, meaning you can go wakeboarding without a boat. And it's an awesome community. And Dan has donated a for up to four riders, two-hour learn-to-ride package at a wakeboard park in Rockford, Illinois. Down to, I built a chestnut wooden bench, more about that, what the heck else? several bottles of bourbon still. But consistent with the Wisconsin theme, but also do not forget, I'm confident a lot of your audience has heard the Jimmys, the blues, funk, and soul award-winning, internationally acclaimed, and Jimmy Vaguely, the keyboard-playing monster, vocalist, and songwriter of the Jimmys. His family has been affected. So Tyrannina Brewing Company, doors open at 1, if there were doors. It's an outside event, and we'll get started at 1 o'clock with a tribute, and then we'll get out of the way and let the Jimmys go, and we're going to be live auctioning six of the items off as well.
Now, here, I can't make it because it's Larry Mueller Day at the Mallards game.
It's always Larry Mueller Day.
And I get to throw out the first pitch and all that. So, but I noticed that you can make a donation online if you do not.
Conveniently enough, those arrangements have been made. And, of course, you can go. We don't really care who gets the credit so long as the donations go to the people who are doing the work. Because you mentioned the Alzheimer's Organization. They are wonderful people. They have celebrities like Samuel L. Jackson out in front for them. The initiative is stuck with us low-budget foot soldiers like me, in which case you can go to the UW Initiative to End Alzheimer's or Minds Over Mountains, UW. Minds Over Mountains, UW. And it will take you right to our page, tell you a little bit about what we've been up to and how you can contribute.
And the money goes
to our research at UW-Madison. So we've been accused of being too modest in what we do here at UW, so maybe I'll try to take off my Midwestern hat. But again, we have a team at Wisconsin that is doing really important groundbreaking research and trying to find better blood tests, brain scans to find dementia earlier, way before memory symptoms start. So we have amazing researchers in, again, blood tests, imaging. We also have a huge array of clinicians who are doing research on how do these illnesses affect our day-to-day living? How do they affect caregivers? How do they affect families? And then we're doing therapy studies as well, so looking at different types of medications that attack amyloid and the other protein tau. We have studies that look at gut health. We have studies that look at exercise. We have all kinds of research studies and a really talented group of researchers. And it's not just the researchers. I think what's really unique about Wisconsin is this Wisconsin idea coming to life, that we have thousands and thousands of research participants who are behind this work, who are partnering with us, who are amazing advocates for this work. And then, you know, people like Bill and others who come around alongside of us and help contribute, raise awareness, and really put wind in our sails to keep us working on this area. But a lot of great research is happening right here in our backyard. So a shout out to my colleagues and the participants in our studies and the community members who are making that happen.
Yeah, and I'll even build on that, because that was my entry point, because this started with a conversation with my friend Becky Jeffers, who very humbly said, hey, I work in this lab at the UW-Madison. Well, that lab you're about to hear from Dr. Chin was largely responsible for the FDA approving the use of blood biomarkers in Alzheimer's detection. And here again, Cindy lightly referred to the clinics around the state of Wisconsin. The clinics that Dr. Carlson established to educate caregivers is a model in the United States. People come to Wisconsin to learn how to help care for people with cognitive decline.
Amazing, amazing story here at going on at Wisconsin, for sure. And Jason in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Jason, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Appreciate you guys bringing attention to this. So my question regards the clotho protein. So I've heard some podcasts about this as being a potentially neuroprotective protein, and I understand there's some animal studies, but I was just kind of curious on the current state of that and if there's any human trials going on with that.
That's a great question. We have a colleague, Dr. Oziomo Okonkwo, who does studies on clotho gene. And so he and his lab and partners at University of California, San Francisco, have done a lot of research on that, helping to show how it affects humans, so in human studies. So I encourage you to look on our website. So at adrc.wisc.edu. And look at Dr. Oziomo Okonkwo's work. He is studying that actively.
All right. Thank you very much, Jason, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk at WPR.org. Janice emailed to say that she heard on a show a person suggesting that Benadryl could cause Alzheimer's. Is there any evidence of that?
Well, Benadryl, the other name is diphenhydramine, and it's in a lot of pills that are available at the drugstore. So anything that says PM at the end has Benadryl in it. And Benadryl is a medicine that works pretty much exactly opposite to medicines that help with dementia, like Aricept or donepezil. So Benadryl makes people's thinking clouded. It affects the chemical balance in our brain. So we try to avoid using Benadryl or anything with PM in it at the end, like Tylenol PM. Tylenol itself is okay, but PM or Advil PM, trying to avoid that in people with memory concerns. Whether it truly causes it, that's not quite clear yet. But for sure, we recommend not using that if you have memory changes.
Theron emailed to say they understood that there was a connection between the use of aluminum and Alzheimer's. Theron's parents always said not to use aluminum pans, limit drinking out of aluminum cans, and avoid overcooking food in foil. Is there research on aluminum and its connection to Alzheimer's?
That is a great question. So decades ago, there was a lot of concern about aluminum contributing to Alzheimer's disease. But thankfully, there have been a lot of good research studies that show that cooking with aluminum, contact with aluminum products does not seem to have effect on Alzheimer's risk. So I use aluminum without any concerns at all. So I think it's pretty safe. Again, there's lots of evidence now, but that was a concern in the past. And so your parents were being cautious with what people knew at the time.
So are there, another email, are there ways to prevent Alzheimer's disease from John?
There's no established prevention right now with medicines, but there's a good study. It was called the U.S. Pointer Study that showed that exercise, staying cognitively healthy or staying cognitively active, eating healthy diet, like Mediterranean diet, that helps delay onset. So the lifestyle interventions have the best evidence so far, and controlling blood pressure. If you want to take away one message today, control your blood pressure for your brain health. There's two studies, though, that in the next year or two are going to be released to see if the medicines that help remove amyloid from the brain, so that lecanemab and donanemab, they're going to look and see if that helps prevent Alzheimer's. So no established prevention medicines yet. Lifestyle helps, and controlling blood pressure is very important.
So the prognosis of someone diagnosed with Alzheimer's, there's a question relating to that.
Yeah, the prognosis really depends on a lot of factors. So unfortunately, Alzheimer's always progresses if it's truly Alzheimer's. And again, you have to use the blood test that Dr. Chin's going to talk about to really support whether it's truly Alzheimer's or not. There's a lot of other things. You know, if somebody has sleep apnea, medication side effects, or like we were talking about before, if there's another type of brain change that's going on at the same time. So it really affects how people progress, how quickly it progresses. There's some types of dementia that we didn't even know about before. That's the abbreviation for it is called LATE because it stands for something really long, the limbic predominant age-associated TDP-43 encephalopathy. That's why we call it LATE. And that looked like Alzheimer's disease in people who are in their mid-80s. And then we found out that it was actually caused by something else. And so that condition seemed to progress more slowly and came on later in life. So there's a lot of factors that influence how quickly someone progresses. In general, they will progress if it's truly Alzheimer's, but how quickly they progress depends on if they have other factors that are accelerating that change.
Aaron emailed to say his mother is exhibiting signs of dementia, but his father is in denial and doesn't want to have her diagnosed. Any words of advice for him to help persuade his dad to have his mom tested?
That's a great question. That's why we have memory clinics all over the state, is because we know that early diagnosis is helpful, because not only does it help get rid of things that maybe are contributing, like if there's if somebody's on a medication that causes negative thinking of changes, then they can stop that medicine or pick a new one. So there's a lot of things we can do to help protect people's memory. And the other thing, too, it opens up access to resources. So if you find out someone has Alzheimer's, then you can go to local community agencies and find out resources that they have, caregiver support, all kinds of things. So we really encourage people to get diagnosed early. It tends to be a scary thing, but if the disease is there, the disease is there. It's not going to change whether or not you know about it, but having the knowledge is power and helps people access resources and support they need.
It's and the support, I mean, for those who are supporting folks with Alzheimer's, that is a very difficult job.
It's a very difficult job. I think you both have lived it personally.
So the help that's available for those folks, maybe you could talk a bit about that.
We have strong partnerships with our state Department of Health Services, and they have a program throughout the whole state of Wisconsin. Every county and tribe in the state has an Aging Disability Resource Center, or ADRC. And within each ADRC, there's a dementia care specialist. And that person is trained to connect people with resources in their counties. So whether that be day programs or caregiver support groups or in-home resources. But again, looking at the Aging and Disability Resource Centers, finding their dementia care specialist. And I encourage my patients and families just to call them and say, this is my situation. What resources do you think would be helpful for me? Making it simple.
Sometimes it's just people having a chance to get away from.
Yes.
Because the people I know who have been involved in this, often they're the only one, or there's not a lot of help from anybody else.
Yes.
A family member or something.
And I think every caregiver says they waited too long to get help. Everyone I've talked to who said they wish they had asked for help earlier.
And lots of communities and hospitals and support groups will have adult daycares. mm-hmm. where you can take your family member with dementia and get a break.
Yeah, and I can remember my mother actually, at least at the one stage, mid-stage maybe, really enjoying going to those events that happened to be in Sun Prairie, but she really had a wonderful time.
And that's what I encourage families too. Again, the person living with dementia can be a great blessing to the other people there and enjoy it and you know, be a resource and someone for someone else to talk to as well. So,
and I remember taking my mother to the Villas Park Zoo. I could take her there every weekend, and it was always like a new experience.
You can take me there every weekend, and I'll enjoy it too.
Oh gosh, and Bill, let's go back to how people can. There's the event this weekend on the 14th.
There is the event on the 14th at the Tarnina Brewing Company in Lake Mills, Wisconsin. And if, for example, you have a son or a daughter graduating and you're not able to make it, or if it's your day at the ballpark, then by all means, there's Minds Over Mountains UW. That page will take you to everything we do and how you can contribute and how you can get on board. But if you are able to make it to the Tyranina Brewing Company, it's an amazing day of fundraising, yes, fellowship, and absolutely a good time because the Jimmies are worth the price of admission, which, of course, is zero. So if you find the value of the entertainment in that place on that day in excess of the cover charge, there will be an opportunity that you can donate to the initiative.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with both of you today. I want to thank you both very much for being with us and for the work you're both doing, actually. I know it's a long... I'm not going to live to see the end of Alzheimer's, unfortunately, but...
Well, when it started out, I met Steve Ramig, and I said, man, I don't want my kids to have to worry about the same Alzheimer's as I do. And his response was, Bill, it may not be too late for you. That's how close we are. So, and things change by the minute.
Well, hopefully with some more funding and some more dollars and the great people we have here at UW and elsewhere, we're going to get a handle on it.
Well, and Larry, we have, on a complete aside, God bless you and thank you for 50 solid years. One of our auction items is a Joe Thomas autographed jersey, the Iron Man of the NFL, 10 years, never missed a snap. You were in that seat for 50 years longer than Joe Thomas played football, so.
Well, it's been my pleasure and my honor to do it, and I want to thank you both.
Thank you so much for bringing attention to this and for your contributions to our community and beyond.
Bill Stark and Dr. Cynthia Carson. Dr. Cindy Carson is the director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. Bill Stark, of course, Lake Mills veterinarian, but he's organized a fundraiser for Alzheimer's research this coming Sunday. Or if you can't make it there, go to Minds Over Mountain.
UW. Minds Over Mountains, UW.
And you can make your contribution there. And we're going to stay with Alzheimer's, but it come up a couple of times that we had a blood test for Alzheimer's, and we're going to go into the details with that with Dr. Nathaniel Chen. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, about 7 million Americans live with Alzheimer's disease, and that number is projected to rise to, I think, around 13 million. But there's a new blood test for Alzheimer's that can diagnose people and provide them with a fighting chance, or at least extending life. And we're going to be talking about that new blood test today with Dr. Nathaniel Chen, Dr. Nate Chen, an associate professor in the Division of Geriatrics and Gerontology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He is also director of medical services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. Dr. Chin is also author of a new book. I want to mention that book and talk about that for a bit, too. It's titled When Memory Fades, What to Expect at Every Stage, From Early Signs to Full Support for Alzheimer's and Dementia. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Family member suffering from Alzheimer's, if a blood test could determine your risk for Alzheimer's disease, would you take it? Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Nate Chin, welcome. Great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be back.
We've got lots that we can talk about here. A year ago, I think it was the U.S. Food and Drug Administration provided clearance to a blood test to test for access or maybe to assess Alzheimer's disease. How big a breakthrough was that for diagnosis of the disease in patients?
Well, I think you used the right word, Larry. It really improves access. It improves our ability to reach people who historically have not been able to come into an academic center or a memory specialty center to get an accurate diagnosis. And so I think it is pretty revolutionary in our space, and it's going to open a lot more doors for the future, too.
And it's a very accurate.
It is very accurate, and of course that you have to go through some pretty rigorous testing in order for the FDA to clear such a test to be used clinically. And in our own program at Wisconsin contributed up to 40% of the data that was used by the FDA to lead to that conclusion that these blood tests, well, I should say these specific tests that were approved or cleared, were accurate in detecting the protein.
And how widely is this test being used now as a tool to benefit patients?
Well, I still don't think it's as widely used as I think people probably think. It takes time for a healthcare institution to adopt it, to have procedures in place. And it certainly takes a lot of time for clinicians to feel comfortable with understanding when to order it, how to talk to their patients about it before they order it, and then definitely how to talk about the result afterwards. And so it isn't something where the FDA clears it and then the next week it's in your clinic. It can take months, even years for some institutions, just based on the processes and the administrative aspect of it. More and more places are doing it for certain, though.
And at the UW?
The UW, we're early adopters, and our clinicians were certainly a part of this process from the very beginning. And Dr. Bob Brzezbelski has really led a huge effort on our geriatric side and the neurology team as well in bringing this to the clinic and to our patients. And so we've been doing it for over a year now.
So there's access here in Wisconsin. Anywhere else in the state do you know?
Yes, actually, up north, close to the Mayo Clinic in La Crosse, there are providers getting that type of testing, and in Milwaukee as well. And I know I've had patients coming from the Green Bay area that have had this testing. And so it is worth asking, does your healthcare institution have this test? And then which are the providers that actually order it? Because one of the tests that was cleared is meant for specialists, so that would be neurologists, geriatricians, or someone in a memory clinic. And then another test is actually meant for primary care, but the purpose of it is not to identify and diagnose Alzheimer's. It's actually to rule it out. So a negative test means you don't have it, but a positive test we're just not as sure about.
Ah, I see. So if a patient, or let's say somebody has a mother and a sister and maybe a brother, all with Alzheimer's, would that be an appropriate, but the person does not exhibit any of the issues. Would it be used under a circumstance like that, for example?
That is a great scenario that you've painted there, Larry. And so the answer to that right now is no. And so the current blood test has been validated and proven to be accurate in those who already have symptoms and actually have impairments on those thinking tests that most people choose not to do and hate, which is understandable. But we, you know, the test is meant to be done in someone with a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or a diagnosis of with dementia. And once you have that diagnosis, that's when your provider would say, well, I believe Alzheimer's disease, this biology in the brain, is the cause of that condition or not, but I want to get this blood test to see if that's true. And so you do have to go through a pretty thorough evaluation first before you would actually get this blood test.
Yeah, I was wondering, when you say mild cognitive impairment, what would be, how would that be exhibited under what, you know, what would the person have to demonstrate to show what mild cognitive impairment?
Yeah, so I mean, mild cognitive impairment is a really important stage because we believe that a lot of intervention can happen, particularly here. And so really it starts with someone saying, I have thinking changes. And it's either the person or maybe the family or friends surrounding them that notice, you know, you're just having more mental lapses than what we would think of as typical aging, so more often, more consistent, more persistent. And they would then talk to their primary care provider about this observation and concern. The primary care provider would then do a nice thorough workup where you do some, you look for reversible causes, you get some blood work, you really explore the history of those thinking changes. And Larry, you assess for day-to-day functional change because someone with mild cognitive impairment is still independent. They are not having impairments or inabilities to do the things they do every day, like manage their finances or drive or cook or clean. And so that history is really critical. And that then leads to sort of this evaluation and eventual diagnosis.
Sherry in Oshkosh emailed to ask the difference between Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, cognitive decline, and memory loss.
Yeah, that's such an important question. I'm glad Sherry asked it so early in our conversation because it really sets the stage for what can we do. And there's been a lot of confusion, and I really think it's the medical establishment and the scientific community that has led to this because we use the word Alzheimer's to mean so many things like dementia or even mild cognitive impairment, and they are different. And so Alzheimer's disease, we believe, is really just this process occurring in the brain. It's this buildup of two particular proteins, and one's called amyloid, and that's really what the blood tests are looking for, and the other one is called tau. And these proteins just build up, and they cause our brain cells to get sick and die. But a person does not actually need to have symptoms in order to have these proteins in their brain, very much like you can have high blood pressure and not have a stroke. And so Alzheimer's is those proteins. But then mild cognitive impairment, we just described, is having symptoms and changes on testing, but day-to-day you're doing okay. And then in dementia, a person's having symptoms, these lower scores on thinking tests, and they need help with some of those day-to-day functions. And so we really are separating the biology from the things people experience and observe.
Yeah. Frances emailed to say her husband was recently diagnosed with cortical basal degenerative disease, and another physician suggested he may have Huntington chorea, which is hereditary. His mother had dementia, and his dad died in life. And does any of this sound like dementia or Alzheimer's?
Well, and so cortical basal degeneration, you know, it's an atypical form of Alzheimer's disease, and that's, again, because the protein itself is there, but it builds up in a different part of the brain, and it causes different symptoms. And so certain, and Huntington's is not, that's different. But what the caller is speaking to is that there are other processes, there's other biology that can happen in the brain that can cause a person to eventually develop dementia and eventually just develop thinking change. And unfortunately, we don't have blood tests as readily available to diagnose those other brain conditions the way we do with Alzheimer's now. But it took us a long time to get here, and the field is working towards those other diseases. But some of your callers might also be saying, well, I have a family member with Lewy body disease or Parkinson's disease or frontal temporal disease, and all of those are brain diseases like Alzheimer's, but they're different proteins that build up and affect different parts of the brain.
Interesting. Our guest, Dr. Nathaniel Chin, Dr. Nate Chin, is associate professor in the Division of Geriatrics and Gerontology at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, director of the Medical Services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Glad to have you listening in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about Alzheimer's. We've been zeroing in a little bit on the blood test, a very accurate blood test as a tool to tell you whether or not you have Alzheimer's. And it's a big benefit for patients to know, especially early on in the whole disease progression. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest, Dr. Nate Chin from the School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Chin. Jeff emailed to ask, do the fumes from a gas range pilot light or gas range itself, or maybe tainted well water? So a couple different things there. Wondering, could it cause dementia?
Wow, those are very excellent questions, and unfortunately, I can't answer them directly. I will say, though, that Jeff is speaking to, I think, a very important aspect of our cognitive or our brain health, and that is environmental exposures. And so I don't know. So to answer Jeff directly, I don't know about the gas inhalation or tainted well water. But I do. There is building evidence that air pollution is a known and established risk factor for developing dementia. There are groups looking at water quality, in particular PFAS, which of course affects us here in Wisconsin. And so there is this active area of investigation to see what is it about certain environments that increase the risk for someone developing dementia. And a lot of this is going to be tied to inflammation, chronic inflammation, and other sort of altered processes that could happen in the brain. But to Jeff's point, I think we do have to be very careful and very thoughtful about the things that our body is coming into contact with.
Yeah. Dr. Chin, your research and your colleagues' research contributed, as you say, quite a bit to this blood test.
Oh, yes. We're very proud of the fact that we're very proud of our participants. And I think that's why we like to talk about it, Larry, is that, you know, Wisconsin individuals, they come in year after year and they give us their time and their blood and their spinal fluid and they go into these scanners for us. And for so long, you know, we weren't able to show them a lot of what we were doing with that. We were doing a lot of good research with it, but now it really has manifested because of their dedication. We were able to say, look at this blood test and whether it's if it shows this protein or not. Now look at the tests that we know are established and valid, and that's spinal fluid and these PET scans, these imaging scans. And they were able to show that, sure enough, with one of the first tests that was cleared, when you have an elevated protein on that blood test, over 90% of the time you had an elevated result in the spinal fluid or the PET scan. And that's because our participants have come in for years, decades, to do this, and they've allowed us to collect these samples and store them. And so we did give a lot of data to the FDA to assess it, and then they came to the conclusion that this was valid enough for the clinical environment.
Jim in Green Bay has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've had memory issues for quite a long time, and And now I am through numerous tests. I think they said I've got Alzheimer's, and I'm undergoing effusions for this every 2 weeks. I think it's with Leqembi. And I'm wondering what your doctor's take on that. And I function pretty good, but I still got a kind of a short-term memory.
Yeah.
And,
well, Jim, and so you're wondering, well, Dr. Nate Chin, what do you think? Effusions, what are those, by the way?
Yeah, so first I want to thank Jim for calling in, and really it's because of people like Jim that we can destigmatize what it means to have these tests done and to have Alzheimer's and thinking change. So thank you, Jim, for calling and sharing your story. So when a person says they have Alzheimer's disease, a part of me is always a little bit hesitant as to what they mean, because many people still think of Alzheimer's as the same thing as dementia, and hopefully our listeners are hearing that's not always the case. But with what Jim is saying, he was put on a therapy. And that therapy, these new novel agents, what they do is they go into the bloodstream, they go into the brain, and they break down that protein of the first protein of Alzheimer's called amyloid. And you can't be on that therapy unless you have Alzheimer's. So I know from Jim's story that he does, in fact, have that disease because he has the protein. And these drugs have been shown to be very effective at removing the protein in the brain. Unfortunately, you know, they're not stopping the progression of the disease. So as Jim said, he still has, you know, short-term memory changes, and there are declines that will happen over time. But these medications slow that decline in a good percentage of people. And so that really preserves you in your best state. You have the most ability and most function. And as over time, yes, there's change, but it's just occurring at less intensely and less frequently over a period of time. It's not appropriate for everyone. These medications, they have some side effects and risks that Jim had to hear from, you know, from his providers about. But for those that make that decision, it seems like it can be helpful. And certainly there are places throughout Wisconsin that are offering those treatments.
Oh, that's great, Jim. And thank you very much, Jim, for calling. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. Appreciate that very much. I think it was wasn't it 2024 when UW established an expanded biomarker and biofuels lab? Some new technology there. You obviously are familiar with that.
Yeah, actually, I think I was on the show with you, Larry, a couple years ago to talk about a really important study that we are the home base for. So it's called the Clarity Study. It's a national study led by Dr. Sterling Johnson at UW. And what that study does is it allows for all of the Alzheimer's disease research centers. So there's 35 of them throughout the country. We happen to be one here in Wisconsin. But it allows for all of those centers to get blood as well as PET scans to look for not just Alzheimer's disease, but some of the other causes of cognitive impairment. And so we've been a part of that. We've been, frankly, through Dr. Johnson, we've been leading that effort. And it really is allowing for us to develop these tools so that we can identify diseases like Alzheimer's so early that people don't actually have symptoms. And it's, of course, our hope that we can intervene that early and really prevent people from developing symptoms.
Yeah. And what other developments in research are you excited about?
Well, so, I think a lot of it comes down to we need to figure out, you know, what are the factors that lead to progression of disease so that we can intervene and stop that. And I know that the interviews that you had just prior to me, you know, you had this great conversation with Dr. Cindy Carlson, and she's our lead clinical trialist here in Wisconsin or at UW. And so she's going to be leading efforts in the clinical trial space where we can intervene before people have symptoms and then see if we can prevent those symptoms. So I think the clinical trial world is very exciting as far as you have to know that if you have the protein, so that's why the blood test matters so much, but identify those individuals, offer them interventions, and then see if we can actually delay or prevent the development of symptoms. The other thing I'll say that's been really exciting in our field is that more and more people are investing their energy into understanding the experience of living with this disease and how can we support families and caregivers. And so that work being led by Dr. Andrea Gilmore-Bukowski and Nicole Puglia and Beth Fields, I think is really unique to Wisconsin. It speaks to, you know, what we care about in our great state, but it shows that we have to be diverse in our approach. Yes, it's about biology, but really at the end of the day, it's about people and how can we help people.
Well, your new book will be helpful to people as well. And I think it was earlier this month it was published. It's titled When Memory Fades, What to Expect at Every Stage from Early Signs to Full Support for Alzheimer's and Dementia. Tell us about the book.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up, Larry. It did come out just last week on June 2nd. It was a two-year project for me, and it really started because I wanted to share my story as the son of someone who my father had Alzheimer's disease and passed away in 2018 with it, and so I wanted to share some of the lessons that my family and I went through. I wanted to really help people who were in this stage of there isn't a diagnosis, but we're worried, and then how do we get this diagnosis and what is life like after the diagnosis? So really kind of setting the stage before, during, and after. And then also wanting to incorporate some of the great research and care that we're doing right here at UW so that people know what's available and that the field is really accelerating quite quickly and the research is advancing. So it sort of has those three parts to it. And it's been having it out has been quite an experience, Larry, and I love knowing that it's hopefully reaching people that need it.
I'm sure it will. And the title again, When Memory Fades, that's the main part of the title.
Correct.
For people to remember to get a copy. Someone else wondered, are there exercises physically that you should do to keep yourself sharp?
Well, so the exercising, I think, is absolutely critical to keeping a healthy brain. But it really comes down to what a person's realistically wanting to do and able to do. We all have different abilities and different other health factors. And so the goal is to do something almost every day if you can, and if you can get your heart rate up in doing it. And so some of us might be able to run and enjoy running. Others don't. And so they might do gardening, walking. You know, they might want to go on an elliptical machine. And so it's anything that a person feels like causes them to exert themselves, but that they're willing to do on a regular basis.
And for how long per day? Is it 30 minutes a day? Is it...
Yeah, that's another good one. And yes, while I would certainly say 30 minutes is fantastic, I don't want someone to go from 0 minutes per day to 30. And so, you know, it's okay to start at 5 minutes a day and then gradually over weeks increase to 10 to 15. There is some scientific studies to show that at 10 minutes we start to really get those benefits. So if we can start at 10, great. If not, that's a good first goal to have. But the CDC does recommend roughly 150 minutes a week if you can achieve it. But again, that's the goal, and so it's okay to be able to do less for the time being if you're working towards that.
Mm. Well, I still enjoy walking 9 or 18 holes of golf.
Yeah, that counts, Larry. That's a good activity.
when you're walking, it's a great activity. Well, even if you're riding once in a while, you still have to do quite a bit of walking when you get right down to it. But I enjoy the walk. It's a nice walk. Well, Nate, Dr. Nate Chin, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure. This will be our last time to talk on the air together, but I hope we have a chance to meet down the road.
Yeah, Larry, thank you. It's an honor to be on here with you. And again, congratulations on such an incredible career and such an impact for our state.
Well, thank you. And I'm sure Dr. Nathaniel Chin We'll be back again. Lee Rayburn, who's going to be replacing me, is nodding. Yes, that's going to be the case. Dr. Nathaniel Chin, Associate Professor in the Division of Geriatrics and Gerontology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He directs the medical services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. It's great to have him with us. And thank you so much for listening. This and all of our shows, of course, are a team effort, including our producers, Claire Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. And why not stay with us? Lots more in store here on WPR News.